It's Radiothon time again at 3CR. This year marks 40 years of radical radio at 3CR, and we're asking you to keep us on air for another 40 years by donating your money to 3CR's Radical Radiothon. Call us on 03 9419 8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au. Enjoy your podcast.
There is a place where time stands still, where nature is harsh and demanding, where only the quick and the strong and the deadly can survive. This place is no place for civilized man.
I want my land.
Get in the guts, Barry.
Far away from my home.
All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test. Three simple questions, three correct answers,
you get all this
and
together?
You go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world.
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie for Showreel. I'm really not as frightening as they make out on Talkback with Radio, but Talkback with Attitude. But that's okay. Today we're going to have a yarn with a prolific independent filmmaker. That's Mark Lipkin. I told you about him last week, reminding you that there's going to be an event at the Bespoke Cinema, Eclipse Cinema, down in Wellington Street in Collingwood, on Friday. That's tomorrow, the 22nd of May, at 7:30. There's going to be a Q&A of Mark's Lipkin's latest film, Pelverata. And I did get a chance to have a chat with this fellow. So here we go. We'll have a chat with Mark. So let's look at this interesting film, Pelverata, that you've put together. Is the name reflective of the location?
It is, yes. It's a real locality. It's around 15, 20 minutes from Hobart. Yes, yes. And it's in and around Pelverata and the surrounding sort of areas where we actually shot as well. So
you wrote it and directed it. Yeah. Did you shoot it or was someone else shooting it?
No, I had someone else. I had Alexander Norton, who's the one that shot it. So he shot my last film as well. So got him on board to do this one as well. So I tend to find my place behind the camera. I'm not very I'm not very technically savvy when it comes to cameras and all that sort of stuff. I know they work and all that.
You know what it is you want.
Yeah, yeah. I'm no Steven Soderbergh. I'm sort of doing everything. I'm certainly not that. So yeah.
Tell me about the shoot, because it's all outside. So it must have been quite challenging.
Yeah, no, it was. It's not my first rodeo with outside sort of shots, but this one is definitely very challenging given how remote some of the places were. And obviously we shot in a combination of private land as well as national park. So it's getting there. There was a bit of work done beforehand, a bit of a recce to work out where we'd shoot, how it would work. And that all of that encompasses, you know, the technical stuff. How do you get people here? How do you get gear down? You know, what's the weather looking like? And the weather does, it never really cooperates, especially when you're shooting outside with essentially almost no lighting at all. You're just relying on the sun out there. So that was definitely interesting, because when you do shoot outside, if you're framing a shot, the worst time is you've got clouds and you've got a bit of sun. So you might shoot something, it's overhead, you got the happening, and then you're taking the same shot again and the sun's out and it almost looks like two different shots. So that's probably a really big one. We had to sort of work our way around, but we managed to do it nonetheless. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's explore some of the themes, because quite clearly it starts off, they're doing a job, but then it sort of devolves into the worst possible pairing of workmates.
Yeah.
But then it goes into a far deeper kind of psychological drama, and then an embracing of the environment in a way that's quite disturbing.
Yes, absolutely. I think, as you rightly put, the big element around the film is the environment is actually, it's not just a place that they're in, it's the third protagonist, if you want to use that sort of logic. I always look at these sort of things as obviously your two layers. So you've got your narrative layer, the standard film arc, you've got two surveyors, they're out there, there's obviously dynamics between the two. They have their own personal histories as well, so that unfolds as we go. We have a bit of a polar opposites, but they're very much sort of the same at to some degree. So there's very much that follows a standard arc. You've got things in there where you've got mental health issues with Misha, where he's trying to conceal the fact that he forgot his antipsychotic medication behind. He slowly starts going off the rails. His partner in crime, Mairi, in the film, she obviously attempts to salvage the mission, but then realizes it's too late. And then, but then what we start noticing is that deflection around is him losing his medication, the thing that's actually, is it the reason for his psychosis? So we see him from the side of view of is he losing it because of the medication? But then we slowly start to see Mairi also connect to something else in the environment. And so essentially in the second part of the act, the lines begin to blur whether it's actually within him or it's something outside of him. And she's our lead in to help guide us through that part of the story, if that sort of makes sense.
From the point of view of a colonial perspective, there is quite a raw nerve
Yes.
being pushed, isn't
Yeah,
it?
absolutely. So that's a really important theme throughout the entire film. So the idea that I took sort of moving into this was, and again, as far as the idea itself, it's not a new idea. Ideas like this have been persisted throughout millennia, where the essential landscape is something that can hold trauma. It can actually hold memory. So it's there. Look at physics, look at the third law of thermodynamics. Energy is not created, nor destroyed. It moves from one point to the other, basically. So the idea with this is that things that happen, the environment acts as a recorder in essence. So how it records, the mechanics around that's the ambiguity that the film essentially explores. The historic genocide, Tasmania, if you read the history, it is steeped in, I don't want to brush over like the important, historical topics there, but there's a significant amount of, the Palawa, the Aboriginals, they were essentially almost destroyed, like essentially down to over the last, within the last 100, 110, 120 years. So the idea with that is that it's still in the environment, it's still in the landscape, it exists, it doesn't go away. And I think that's the key thing that I'm trying to sort of explore with Colorado. So their connection to country, what happened to country as well, all of that, it remains, it's still there. Despite the fact that optically we can't see it, it doesn't mean that stuff hasn't happened and that energy is there. So the film then connects to that side of the narrative. It connects to the Mairi specifically in the film that she has indigenous roots about her. And it's something that she's kind of steered away from. She's obviously professionally trying to create a career, but those roots are deep. And the idea is that your DNA holds memory, and your entire lineage of your people, it is, again, this is my view, and it's explored elsewhere as well.
Well,
Um,
it's a
that
Jungian approach, isn't it?
It is an ignorant approach, but at the same time, if you look at it even, physically, you're born with certain genes. Those genes have come from somewhere. So the genes themselves, and they hold the memory as well, and the landscape holds the memory. So the underlying current, what we're doing with Mairi, she's actually connecting to that in ways that she has no idea about. She's like connecting to something that's both so scary but so natural as well. And then the culmination point, obviously, without giving too much away what happens at the end of the film, there is a major ground where there was a major massacre, and there have been major massacres throughout Tasmania. Cape Grim's a good example, but there's a lot of massacres that aren't documented. There's a significant amount of them.
As soon as you call something Sealer's Cove, you know that there's an undertone.
Oh, exactly. 100%. I went in there thinking and just like learning and just speaking to people. And just the amount of, and I know you can say, is it anecdotal, is it historical? You're not quite sure. But there's a lot of smaller things. They are a massacre, like four or five people hunted down, and it barely made a statement. So the idea of Pelverite, it brings that together to say that all of these things happen, and not just in Tasmania, throughout Australia, throughout other all around the world, but specifically in Australia, specifically in Tasmania, it's something that it hasn't gone away. and events happen, it's there in the landscape, and we've got people that are, and the stories about showing that what you don't see is precisely what you should be seeing, basically.
You said you can't see it visually. There was a couple of elements in the film that was is interesting on a visual level. They're sitting there, and then suddenly I realized that the light has moved across in the trees. It's a quite freaky kind of element to the visuals. But also, of course, the sound. The sound is really important, isn't it?
The sounds in this film, it's particularly important. The score was very important to get the sound right, and we're a very a good team. Our sound designers on board the team, Prue, who's the sound designer for the film, she did a spectacular job in putting it together in a way in which it's like, holy crap, it makes sense. And then bringing in obviously the composer as well, who's from overseas, to bring that out. The whole idea is fluid. So I think going back to what you were saying before with the light, that was a particular point where we had one shot at this one scene and the light did change. So that was unintentional, it just happened. And there were a lot of things like that throughout the shoot that happened. And I was obviously so focused on like getting stuff done. And when you sit down at the end of the day and you exchange stories, it's like, holy crap, was some of this like coincidental? So it was a lot of that.
Australian bush is beautiful, but then you go out to the sea, and there's a shot in particular where we've got a silhouette of Murray, and the color is just spectacular, spectacular shot. So
Thank
the
you. It's
editing.
the editing's key as well. I should really do a shout out to Carl Marchant, who's my old partner in crime and edited this film. That was part of the spatially the idea in the film as well. So they're sort of in the forest confines them, and they're always in this like this pressure. Like so the end part of the film is you're changing the landscape, but you're changing their frame of mind as well. They're walking out into this vast space. But that was on Bruny Island, yeah, that behind Arch Beach, and now. All of that's so connected, that whole landscape. And you've got the Big Lagoon from where Triganini, who's from her whole family, they lived up in the Big Lagoon, which was where we shot the final scene of the film as well. None of it was disconnected, even though you've got the forest, you've got the sea, you've got the sand, you've got the rocks, all of those things, it is one canvas basically. So that was kind of the planning around how we chose the locations and the shots and that sort of stuff as well.
Oh, and of course, the opening sequence where they're plotting using satellite, it's a direct comparison between what Western ideas are about the usefulness of land and the control of land versus what land is, which is what happens in the as they get lost. They get lost. They get lost in themselves as well as in the landscape.
100%. After finishing it, you delve deeper into it and you're like, well, what's this all about? And that's really the nexus there. You've got a Western side thinking that comes in and says, I can partition the land, and this is the mechanism I'm going to use. Here it is. We're surveyors. But then what they're actually doing is in itself, the act of partitioning, the act of surveying, it's an imposition into why they're there in the first place. It's a complete imposition. While they've created a story in their heads, like this is, we're professionals, this is what we're doing. And that's part of the idea in this film that it shows that you might be surveyors out in the bush. You have a role to play, but it has a much deeper meaning to that, much deeper. It's you're partitioning something. Without actually knowing what you're with you're partitioning something that can't be partitioned. It's not a land is land. It's not, it's like country's country. It's not, it can't be partitioned. That's something that we introduce. So that's broadly some of the ideas it wrestles with as well. And that's some of the ideas that after shooting it, I sort of looked at it and went, holy crap, there's layer number five now. You know what I mean? So that's kind of that, yeah.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
The 3CR Radiothon kicks off in June. To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 94 19 8377,
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Yeah, we are celebrating 50 years, and there's many people out there who are listening who would have been part of the fabric of 3CR in the doing from the very beginning when they were down in Cromwell Street in Abbotsford, and they made crawled their way up to Smith Street and to the Fitzroy site of Smith Street, in fact. Which is always a bit funny when you consider the huge amounts of changes that have happened socioeconomically in this inner city suburb. Started off as one of the very first suburbs. In fact, it seems mind-blowing to think that my father's grandfather built his house himself in Hope Street in Brunswick when they first did the subdivisions. So in actual fact, family stories can trace these experiences straight back to different parts of this city. We might be moving into catastrophes that are created by the love affair with the pretend world of digital. But still, there's real life going on, and the great 3CR handmade radio still applies. Use the new and use the old to make the best, a bit like Rumpelstiltskin. So don't forget to throw a bit of money into the coffers to keep us going for another year. If you're pleased listening to Showreel over the years, then say that you're throwing a little bit of moolah behind the continuation of Showreel. Our live program, it's always live, but when we're going to go a little bit over some of the ground that we covered for your listening pleasure, it will be live after the live Talkback with Attitude Cash for Comment program on the 11th of June. So call up, go online, don't forget, we're all in it together. This is we've been listening to a little chat with the quintessential independent filmmaker that happens to personify, I guess, the spirit of filmmaking locally. This is Mark Lipkin. He's made his latest film. He's made five. This is his latest film, Palverata, set in Tasmania. They're doing a screening down at Eclipse Cinema on Friday, tomorrow, the 22nd of May, at 7:30. There's going to be a Q&A, very intimate affair, and this is the last part of my conversation with Mark.
Well, we've talked about this particular film, but it turns out you're a prolific filmmaker, apparently. Tell me about your filmmaking journey.
So I've made five films, including this one so far, all feature films over the last 17 years without any government backing or essentially me taking financial risks and really dedicated crew and cast, you know, providing their time and their effort. And without them, it's, you know, these kind of films don't get made. So I've been doing it a while. I've got plenty of scripts and films that I've made as well. And prolific aside, I think for me, like, the process has always been, if I think about it, it's the making of, it's the self-expression, it's the creating, I guess, versus the traditional film industry, which is the commoditization of the creating. You know, it's still to this day, the industry is always like, it's like chalk and cheese. It's never sort of brought me in. I've never been a part of it. I have never really had a leg up at all for about 17 years. But that's a blessing in disguise. That's the way that I see it, because a lot of filmmakers, a lot that I've spoken to, I still speak with today, there's a certain mentality around, again, the thinking around asking for permission. Like, all right, I've got a great script. Let's go get funding. I think if you box yourself into that thinking all the time, you slowly start adapting and wearing down to what the industry actually wants. And what the industry wants now, it's, you know, it's all data-driven, AI structured, what sells, what doesn't. So the insights are great. You know, I was in that situation in 2006, 2007 with my first feature film, where I didn't start with, hey, is this going to sell? Who am I going to distribute it? Like, you don't get me wrong, you have to think that way. But you have to be genuine for what, you know, what are the purposes? Why are you doing it? What's your intent? You know, why put yourself in complete financial disarray, which I've done many times. But it's like journaling. It's part of, you know, you go journal something, you know, it's there was the particular date, particular point in time. And that's for me, more of me as a, what you probably call a, I call myself more a storyteller rather than a filmmaker. Filmmaking happens to be a medium. So
Did you choose this medium? What happened? What happened? What was the hook?
I do a bit of writing, so I've got three books that I've done to date. Actually, four. One, the fourth one I had isn't published. That's an older one. It's always attracted me more around. Like I'll give you an example. One of the first films I'd ever that really sort of moved me a bit was Andrei Tarkovsky's Stalker, and then Mirror as well, which I watched sort of back to back. And you know, that sort of completely absorbed me. And I'm like, wow, this is like, you know, you can write volumes about what you see on screen or do that. And then I'm watching 21 Grams by Alejandro González Iñárritu, who's a Mexican film director. Excellent, excellent film, like master. So I saw 21 Grams. It was his first foray into feature filmmaking after doing commercial work for some time. And then after watching that, I'm like, I've got to do this. No idea how I'm going to do it. I just got to do it. So, yeah. So that's kind of, it was a non-linear kind of drop into the whole.
I understand. And so what have you learned on the way, you know, in the creation of the object that you're making? What have you learned?
I would say probably the most important thing is how the idea grows. I don't mean that in the abstract. So they say there's obviously three films. There's one that you write, there's one that you shoot, there's one that you edit. And that's just the reality of the process in and of itself. What I've actually learned through the process is, and I'm still learning, I've still got a ton to learn.
Well, of course.
So the big thing that I'm learning at the moment is being heavily open to the idea that whatever you put on the page, however the dialogue changes with the actors, whatever you shoot, whatever's edited, that's still an evolving process. You got to work out how you grow within that process. What where you started out, what you thought the film was about, what the ideas were, and what actually and what they became. And Pulverata is a perfect example of that. The way the film I initially started the film, my initial script that I wrote was a lot more genre centric. There was a lot more fast paced. There was a lot more, you know, going on. So it kind of pandered to convention a lot more than what you actually sat down and watched. So when we went to the shots, when we looked at everything, when I looked at how I wanted to do it, I realized this is a different kind of story, and the story has to unfold naturally in this way. And only after the edit, only after everything's said and done, you look at it and say, wow, that's a really interesting film that I had no idea it was going to be that from when I initially wrote, you know, the first draft. That's probably the biggest thing I've learned, and I'm still learning, that being open, being accepting, being open to the fact that it's nothing set in stone, and the ideas that you have, they will evolve, they'll branch into other ideas that exist down, you know, as the film progresses, and just being open to bring all of that in and not discard any of those other ideas, because those other ideas is what makes the film at the end of the day.
Well, so. You see, you talk about Stalker. Mm. I was wondering about did you have sort of concepts of visuality as well as pacing? Because that's exactly what Tarkovsky does. I mean, you become completely lost in the world that you've created.
Yeah, so 100%. So for me, what he uses, like, I think, I can't remember, I'm going to get it wrong, but like, I think it's called time pressure or something like that. So the idea is the film is, it's more than just, the film is an ability for you to kind of put yourself in there. And, you know, we get that a lot with horror movies where people like to feel that excitement, but know they're safe in a cinema, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the thing with Tarkovsky is a broader position. And for me,
what I reckon it is it's physical, but actually it's mental. You're actually inside your own head while you're actually watching something that's been created, which is quite
absolutely
unusual.
Yeah. It's a weird, it's a paradox. You're spot on. It's a really weird paradox. Like, I've always wanted to do this kind of film, Pavarotti. So my previous film, My False Vacuum, that won the Swedish International Film Festival for Best Feature, like 2022. That was a road drama. It was very, very drama centric, but it was good. It was a strong, I really enjoyed that, making that. And then with something like Pavarotti, the idea was, I spent a lot of, I've do a lot of hiking and mountaineering. I've spent days on end through like in alone in the forest. I've done that. You sit down on the chair, golden hour comes, and you just absorb by this all-encompassing environment. So with Pavarotti, I'm like, I want to bring that to the screen. That's what I want to do with this film. That's exactly, and how I do that, I've got no idea. I just need to go to that environment. I'm going to find it, and it's going to evolve differently. And that is when you're taking that angle and you're exploring those ideas in the environment. The film, it has to breathe every scene. You can't just shift and change and shift. And I've got when I edited this with Carl, there was a lot of scenes that they had to breathe. I didn't want cuts in between scenes. Some of the most important scene at the very end, without giving too much away what happens. Technically, it was structured. I structured it so meticulously that it would, give the audience everything, and the audience would have that shock factor at the end. But then the entire shot is done in one shot, in one scene, and that was you don't have. The emotional exhaustion of the actor to go through all of that, it's very difficult because you've got a shot that'll go for 8, 9 minutes that you're trying to shoot. And I exchange that, I exchange the environment, and that's just something happens at the end. It's not about the thing that happens at the end, it's more about the
The
flow.
process.
And you can only achieve that with a long shot. So you can't, it's from my point of view, that's my humble opinion.
And of course, you're going to have a screening for Pavarotti down
Yes.
at Eclipse in Melbourne.
Yep, this Friday on
Oh, this
the
Friday, the
20th
22nd,
at 7:30 p.m.
with a Q&A.
The film's coming up, the screening on Friday, 7:30 at the Eclipse Cinema. I'll be there, so if anyone wants to watch it, ask me any question you want. I'll be there. It'll be good to connect.
And yeah, he will be there. Be good to have a yarn with him if you're an aspiring filmmaker. Coming up next is Published or Not. Don't forget, Radiothon's coming up the 11th of June. If you want to, you can go online. Otherwise, you can do it old school. Give us a call. As I said, Published or Not, coming up next. We're going to go out with New Moon from Ort Weavers.
Sky and the whispering reeds. Life grows upwards and out under moonlight. Will I find comfort? Will I find peace? In the mirrored water of moon over sea. Thank you. down on paper and sing it to be. You will.
You've just been listening to a podcast produced at 3CR Community Radio. 2016 marks 40 years that 3CR has been bringing you independent community voices, and we're asking you, our listeners, to keep us going for another 40 years by donating to our Radical Radiothon. This year, we need to make $220,000, so any amount you can afford makes a big difference. Call us on 03 9419 8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au. Thanks for supporting Community Radio.